Our text for this morning is going to be Exodus chapter 7 and verse 8 through to chapter 10 and verse 29. So I won't read that because it's quite long. If you could sort of have your Bibles open somewhere in the middle of that text, we'll be covering some of that ground this morning. But what I'll read from is chapter 9 and verse 13, which is the beginning of the seventh plague, the plague of hail. So chapter 9, verse 13, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Rise up early in the morning and present yourself before Pharaoh and say to him, Thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. For this time I will send all my plagues on you yourself and on your servants and on your people so that you may know that there is none like me in all the earth. For by now I could have put out my hand to strike you and all your people with pestilence, and you would have been cut off from the earth. But for this purpose I've raised you up, to show my power, that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. For this purpose I've raised you up, to show my power, that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth.'" Unprecedented. That's the word that we've heard so often in the past few months. It's a word which has been in speeches in Parliament. It's been woven into all those press briefings by politicians and chief medical officers. It's the word which has been behind the unheard of levels of government borrowing. £303 billion we've borrowed. Staggering. It's a word which has been behind draconian laws that have suddenly been ushered through Parliament, and for the revoking of basic human rights. All the time, it's because these are unprecedented times. Well, you know what? I reckon if the Pharaoh of Exodus could have joined one of those presidential prime ministerial online conferences, and if he'd been around, he would have not only wanted to have joined, he would have wanted to have chaired it. Because he was the pharaoh of the greatest superpower that this world has ever known. But he would have scoffed at the idea that what's happened in 2020 and 2021 was somehow unprecedented. He would have said, "You should have been there when things started kicking off in Exodus chapter 7. Now that was unprecedented." I guess the fact that we don't look for a precedent suggests that we know little of our history, or we care little about history. But as we come to the great plague narrative of Exodus, what I want to do this morning is to try to take in the big picture of everything that's going on here. Maybe as we've read this through, probably a number of times in our daily readings over a few days, or we think back to Sunday school when it was over a few weeks that we went through the various plagues, it all seemed to be quite detached, and this relentless, chaotic series of destructions raining down on Egypt. As we take the big picture, put it all together for a moment, we see that there's a very intricate pattern to what is going on here. There's an introduction, a laying down of the gauntlet, if you like, where Moses and Aaron come in before Pharaoh and the magicians, and we have the staff turning into serpent incidents. So there's the beginning, an introduction, then there's a conclusion, the tenth plague, which completely shatters Pharaoh. But between those two points, the introduction and the conclusion, we have this series of nine plagues that we can divide into three cycles of three. And they all follow a very close pattern. They all begin, plague one, plague four, and plague seven, with the same sort of words. Go to Pharaoh early in the morning and say to him. And then in the middle of the cycle, plagues 2, 5 and 8, go into Pharaoh and say to him. And then the end of the cycle, plagues 3, 6 and 9, God simply acts without any information being handed over to Pharaoh. No explanation of what's going to happen. God simply does something through Moses and Pharaoh, through Moses and Aaron. But you say, so what? Well, I think that's helpful on several counts. From a human perspective, as we read through these chapters in Exodus, everything does seem to be chaotic, doesn't it? And out of control. But you take God's big picture and you see that everything is being ordered here and is under control. That helps me today. From our perspective on earth, things often seem out of control, but we remember God is working to his agenda and his pattern. I get that when I read Revelation, don't you? It talks about the chaos and the destructions and the judgments that are let loose on the earth, but God works in fours and sevens. And he works logically. This happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. There is a God who is in control, and also that God is kind. He's patient. God warns the first part of the cycle early in the morning. And then he warns again the middle of the cycle before he acts without warning. And he does that three times in Exodus before the concluding judgment, which comes without warning. Remember, Solomon wrote in Proverbs, "He who is often warned yet keeps hardening his heart is going to be destroyed without warning." Who do you think Solomon was thinking about when he wrote those words? Like, it was probably Pharaoh. God warns and warns. His patience is great, but whatever you do, take him seriously. Don't harden your heart. And as we take that big picture again, we see that there's progression in what's happening in the plague narrative. After a while, Israel begin to be excluded and immunized from what's happening here. And the focus begins to get turned more and more onto Pharaoh himself. I just read you the introduction to the seventh plague. God says, "I'm coming after you yourself now. I could have cut you down by now. I've just given you warnings then. You haven't listened to me. There's progression." There's another thing. There's purpose. And this whole series of judgments has one great purpose. It's obviously there to bring God's people out, to save his covenant people. It's also to bring judgment on an oppressive, godless power. But at the heart of everything is to show Yahweh's power, that his name should be proclaimed throughout all the earth. This passage is about the fame and the glory of God throughout all the earth, throughout all time, everywhere. And it's still doing that today. This is God saying, "I want you to know me." And I think there's a real generosity in God's judgments here. Here's my first point. Yahweh proclaims his preeminence. It's stamped all over these chapters. Chapter 7, verse 5. "The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the people of Israel out from among them." Chapter 7, verse 17. "By this you shall know that I am the Lord." Chapter 8, verse 10. This is in response to Moses saying, "You can name when you want the frogs to be removed, what time you want. Be it as you say," Moses says, "so that you may know that there is no one like Yahweh, our God." Chapter 9, verse 14. "So that you may know that there is no one like me in all the earth." It's about God. Now, you might be thinking, is the Lord so insecure and so unstable that that he has to go around causing all this hullabaloo in Egypt so that everybody sits up and knows who he is? Well, no, God is not insecure. God is not unstable, but you are, and I am, and they were. And we have no security, and we have no stability without God. And our greatest need is that we should know for certain who exactly is the Lord and respond to the one true living God and find our stability and our security in him. That's our need. And his great gift to us is that he doesn't hide. He shows himself in his words and he shows himself in his acts. And he declares himself to be the preeminent God of glory and power. We came to chapter 5 in the beginning of that chapter, the first interview between Pharaoh and Moses. And Moses bounces into Pharaoh's presence and says, "The God of the Hebrews, Yahweh, has said that you're to let my people go." And Pharaoh had just fallen about laughing at this point. Who is Yahweh that I should obey him? I don't even know who he is. Well, through these chapters, the Lord is coming to Pharaoh and he's saying, "Good morning." First cycle, early in the morning. "Good morning, let me introduce myself. I'm the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, and there's no one like me." I suppose Pharaoh's question in chapter 5 was sort of understandable. He is the mighty Pharaoh, king over a superpower. The Hebrews are slaves, his slaves. And the Lord, Yahweh, claims to be the God of the Hebrews. That means that he's the God of a bunch of slaves. Could it possibly be that the God of all heaven and the God of all earth, the one true God, is a God of a slave group? The God of the small, the God of the nobodies, the God of the downtrodden. Well, yes, that's our God, isn't it? That is exactly who the God of the Bible is. And he's not ashamed to be called our God. He isn't made glorious by the company that he keeps. He simply is glorious. And he fights for the helpless and the broken and the penitent and the humble in heart. And there is simply no one like him. That's what he's showing you in these chapters. You see it in the introduction. Aaron goes in and casts down his staff and it becomes a serpent in front of Pharaoh. So Pharaoh summons his magicians and they manage to do the same thing by their secret arts. I read the commentaries and people say, well, it's to do with how they could hold a cobra by the back of its neck and it could paralyze the cobra and it would look like a staff and then you'd throw it down on the floor. I'm glad I wasn't an Egyptian magician. I would have failed basic training. Or the back of the head. Sorry. Next. But I don't know whether it was that or whether there's something bigger to it. But the lovely thing is, and you saw it, that Aaron's staff eats up all of their staffs. It's often snakes are us or staffs are us for the Egyptian magicians and some things to put on expenses for them. They're going home staffless. Then we get the first two plagues. We find the magicians are able to replicate what Moses and Aaron are doing with the water being turned into blood and the production of all of these frogs. Again, whether it's through tricks or dark evil powers, it doesn't really concern me. But the fact is that they're not reversing the judgment of God, are they? They're simply adding to the problem. You've got a whole plague of frogs bouncing around the land and the magicians come and produce some more. That's not really helping, is it? What would have helped is if they could have reversed the situation, but they can't. And then by the time we get to the third plague, chapter 8, verse 18, the magicians tried by their secret arts to produce gnats, but they could not. So there were gnats on man and beast. Then the magician said to Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God." Pharaoh, we're out of our depth here. This is beyond our knowledge, beyond our experience. This is supernatural. This is God's work. Then by the sixth plague, when the boils come, we find all the magicians have signed in sick. Chapter 9, verse 11, they can't turn up because of the boils which are on them. Well, this is the Lord. He can announce beforehand what he's going to do, and he's constantly doing that in the scriptures. He's even able to allow Pharaoh to choose the time that one of the plague ends so that Pharaoh doesn't think it's just a coincidence. There's no one like him in all the earth. You think what that meant to Israel. For all these years, they've been crushed by this mighty power. Even the most faithful must sometimes have wondered whether anything could change. Egypt was invincible and just getting stronger. And then in a matter of weeks, under the finger of their God, Egypt is brought to complete ruin. I think what it means to you. Because the God of Exodus 7 to 10 has not changed. He hasn't become small or tired. All he's done is he's shown more and more of his glory and his might and preeminence. Exodus 7 to 10 was just the rehearsal. For us, we live in the aftermath of the greatest demonstration of his glory. When Jesus took on powers that had tyrannized this world for centuries and centuries, for millennia. He took on the powers of sin and Satan and death and darkness, and they lay shattered at his cross. And through resurrection power, he trampled those enemies down. And now he's given all authority and all power, not just over the earth, but also over the heavenly beings. Devils fear and fly before him. Empires rise and fall at his command. He has all preeminence, and he's shown it. And that Jesus is not ashamed to be called your brother and to be identified with you. And he's the Lord of his church, and he reigns over history for the good of his church. The Christian message, the Bible's message, is this is your God. The God of Exodus is your God. He's the God who's revealed himself in Jesus Christ. He is your God. Now that is the Bible's message. It's either nonsense, and we should all go home and never ever come back, or it's true, and we should go on. Your God is preeminent. The second thing that we see here as we look at the whole plague narrative is that Yahweh plagues the Egyptian pantheon. Even from a distance of 3,500 years, we can work out that many of the plagues are not just random attacks on Egypt, but a clinical dismantling of the Egyptian gods. Which, again, I'd argue is a very generous thing for God to do. It's kind, isn't it, for him to show his people, first of all, that they've got nothing to fear from Egyptian gods. And it's also kind for God to show Egypt that they've got nothing to trust in the dead gods that they worship. And what they need to do is to come to know the real God who they're actually in conflict with at the moment. But the first plague takes on the life giver to Egypt, the Nile. You look at it on Google Earth in a moment. You look across the north of Africa, you've got Algeria, it's all sandy and yellow and desert. And you go into Libya, it's all desert again. And you get to Egypt, and wow, green. And you follow the Nile down, beautiful, fertile country. Every year the Nile flooded and it brought life to Egypt. It was represented by the god Hapi in the Egyptian pantheon, and yet here God has taken on Hapi and left him very unhappy as he's turned the Nile into a death bringer, not a life bringer. They worship the goddess Heket, the goddess of fertility. Again, you can find it on Google, pictures of Egyptian gods with a frog's head. That's Heket. It was lovely when the Nile flooded and you had a couple of frogs in your garden croaking away, and you praised Heket for all the good things that she'd brought you. Not quite so good when they're in your bed and your bread bin and your biscuit barrel and your blender, and everywhere you go there's frogs. And then when they die out, that which is supposed to have brought fertility is left in great stinking mountains of rotting carcasses. They worshipped the god Kephi, whose head was a fly. He was the god of rebirth. They worshipped the goddess Hathor, whose head was a cow. The goddess of protection. There's an irony, isn't there? Later on, God says, make sure you get all your cows in when the hail comes, so that you protect them, because they can't protect you. Of course, the great god of the Egyptians was Ra, or Re, the sun god. And yet, when Yahweh takes the Egyptian pantheon on, Re is left in darkness. And of course, Pharaoh himself was supposed to be the incarnation of Ra or Re. And his son was supposed to be the next incarnation of this great god. And then in the final plague, in the middle of the night, up goes the cry of anguish and despair, because Egypt's great hope, the next god, lies dead in his bed. God says, your gods, Egypt, will fail you. They're no gods. Of course, we don't do Hekets and Happies and so on. We're far more sophisticated in our idolatry, far more efficient. We've taken out the middleman now, haven't we? We just get straight to the things that we live for: pleasure, position, leisure, reputation, possessions, health, wealth, lusts. But ultimately, those things fail us. Haven't we had a tiny foretaste of that over this past year? We couldn't do the things that we lived for. The football stadium were shut. We couldn't go on holidays. We couldn't travel. We couldn't party. We couldn't even get our hair cut for a while. And the things that made life — not that getting your hair cut makes life, but it is part of it, isn't it? Well, they were taken away from us and restricted. The book of Revelation, which is so sophisticated, it catches up with where we are today, and it sees the world mourning when the pleasures and the treasures it's lived for simply vanish. And what have you got when what you've lived for goes, if you haven't got the Lord? In the first century, the Apostle Paul could write what he's quoting Jeremiah in the 7th century. Let not the wise man boast in his wisdom, or the mighty man in his might, or the rich man in his riches. But let him who boasts boast in this, that he knows and he understands me, that I am the Lord, practicing steadfast love, justice and righteousness in all the earth. I wonder if we're still boasting in our wisdom. Got the answers, haven't we? Science, We'll save the human race. And then we'll move on and we'll save the planet. You know, you look at us. We can't even structure society properly. Everything's falling apart. Daniel talks about a time when knowledge increases and yet people will run around to and fro. In other words, like headless chickens. We have all this knowledge and yet we don't know what to do. And might has been touched, hasn't it? Health and strength. And wealth has certainly been touched. Riches. I wonder if the Lord is going to have to knock some more. Nothing's changed. It doesn't matter that we can fly helicopters on Mars, because Yahweh is still the Lord. And justice is still justice, and covenant love is still covenant love, and righteousness is still righteousness, and God still made Mars, and he still made you, and he still holds us in his hands, and what matters is that we know him. Nothing's changed. What's our hope in? Well, here's your third point. Your hope is to be in Yahweh, because he is the God who protects his people. From the fourth plague onwards, chapter 8, verse 22, we read, "But on that day I will set apart the land of Goshen where my people dwell, so that no swarms of flies shall be there, that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the earth." And on it goes to all the remaining plagues. God puts this division, this distinction between Israel and Egypt. He is personally sheltering his people. And this is our hope. Our hope isn't in our stuff, our health, our wisdom, our wealth, our might. It's in the covenant care of our ever faithful, omnipotent Lord. Now, that doesn't mean that Christians are immune to the sorrows and the sicknesses of this earth. Adam and I were both telling you last week that many are the tribulations of the Christian in this world. But we don't live under the terror of those things. We're held by the sovereign hand of our Jesus, and we're safe from the ultimate judgment of God. God promises to cover his trusting people from the ultimate judgments. There's always a way of escape, isn't there? There's a flood, but there's an ark. There's a raining down of fire and brimstone onto godless cities in southern Canaan, but there's an angel that's sent to warn and to tell Lot to flee. There's a Passover night, but there's blood that can cover the door and the house. There's a city surrounded, ready to fall, Jericho, but there's a red cord that hangs down that speaks of life and security from Rahab's house. And then, of course, comes what it's all been pointing to, the great covering, Jesus, our propitiation, the one God sends not to inflict plagues, but to bring blessings. I love the way you so often will get a contrast between what's going on in Moses and what's going on with Jesus. Moses brings about the beginning of his ministry by turning water into blood. Jesus announces the beginning of his ministry by turning water into wine. This isn't a plague, Jesus is saying. This is a blessing. This is a time of celebration. This is a time of joy. Jesus doesn't come into the world to cool storms, but still them. He doesn't come inflicting disease, but healing it. He doesn't come to strike with death, but to strike death itself. He doesn't come to plunge the world into darkness, but as the light of the world, he goes into the deepest darkness of God's judgment and by himself covers us there and turns away the wrath of God from us forever and ever. Here shines the grace and the glory of the God of the Bible. This is what your God's like. He's willing to bear the cost of his people's salvation. He receives the blows that his people might be covered. Now do you see why it's so essential that his name should be known in all the earth? Because he's God. And he's good. And he's kind. And he's full of mercy, full of compassion, full of grace. Oh, you say, well, he wasn't to the Egyptians, was he? Are you sure? Let me close with this. Fourthly, he's patient with all. That's that seventh plague, which is the one where men and women made in his image, whether Hebrew or Egyptian, are finally put under mortal danger. They've only been under discomfort before that. Not very nice having gnats and frogs and boils and things like that, but no life has been put in absolute danger until the seventh plague, the hail. And God says, Egypt, bring your servants in. Bring your livestock in. They might not perish. And we read that those who feared the Lord did exactly that. And those who didn't fear the Lord didn't do anything at all. But people took God seriously. And they responded to his warnings and to his promises. God wasn't being anti-Egyptian. In fact, many of the Egyptians ended up joining Israel. And certainly they feared Israel's God. And I have to ask you, do you? Can you say he's my God? He's patient. He's kind. He's full of mercy and covenant love. His heart overflows with forgiveness. His grace extends to the guilty world, a loveless world. And that grace says, come. He's a God who says, I don't take any pleasure in the death of the wicked. What I want is for them to turn. To turn and repent and find life. Why should you die? Why? God doesn't want you to. And it isn't going to be because of ignorance, is it? Because the God who made you has stood up at the time of the Exodus and said, let me introduce myself in all of my power and justice. And he's also the God who has come to you in the person of his Son and said, let me introduce myself in all of my grace and my covenant love. Let me carry what you can't carry. Let me pay what you can't clear. Let me save you. Let me shelter you. I can do that. Because I'm the Lord and there's nobody like me, and I've been doing it from the beginning of time. And I'm happy to go on doing it now. Let me be your God. And he will.